God,
God,
grant me the serenity,
to accept
things I cannot change, courage to change
things I can,
and the wisdom
to know the difference.
Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here in the room tonight in your first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name. You're free to unmute and say hello. All righty then. Debbie, would you do the preamble, please?
Sure. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Debbie.
Hello, Debbie.
AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thanks.
Thank you, my dear. All right, the format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we're very excited to welcome Chris B. from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to come tell his story. And after he finishes up, somewhere around the top of the hour, we'll give him a break and then we'll call for announcements, pass the seven tradition basket. There's Grant. What up, G? We'll pass the seven tradition basket, et cetera. And then we'll get the opportunity to reconvene and ask Chris questions. The questions that we're going to ask him are the questions that you submit. We don't have any in the can ready to go. So please, if you think of something, throw it in the chat to the user questions, please. All right. So very excited to hear Chris. Highly recommended. And I don't want to take up another minute of his time. I give you Chris.
Thanks, David. And so I hope I can live up to these, you know, expectations. And if I don't, Grant's the one you want to blame. So I am an alcoholic. My name is Chris. I just start with a little bit of, my first personal oddity quirk. I forget exactly how far into AA I was when I heard a speaker, introduce themselves that way. You know, traditionally it's, I'm an alcoholic and my name is, and they had this little story, and I say that because I can change my name, but I can't change the fact that I'm an alcoholic. And that really resonated with, someone who went the full, 9 yards with denial. And, and that was about the time, I guess, I was getting to the realization that I really, it wasn't, because I kept playing the game of, when did I cross the line? I crossed the line the moment I shot out of my mom's, my mom. And quite literally, I've apparently been acting like an alcoholic since that time. Apparently in my first day of life, I held my breath until I passed out in the nursery in the hospital. And if that's not self-will worn riot, I don't know what is, an infant that can like do that to themselves. And apparently it's because I wasn't getting what I wanted, and that just when, it's one of those things, not so much anymore, but back then I had to remind myself, it's like, I don't have a choice in this. This is just how I am. I didn't choose it. I didn't, it wasn't because I didn't, get an A in this class in high school or because I didn't, go down this. It's just how I am. And that helped clear away, some of the hurdles I was throwing up for myself. But, to sort of pick up on that early theme. So My earliest memories, are that type of behavior, you know, lying, cheating, stealing, to get what I wanted. I'm blessed, I guess, in some way, and cursed with a pretty good memory. I can remember back to before I was, when I was like 1, 2. Most people can't remember back that far. But I can. And the kind of things I can remember is like biting my dad to get his fat butt out of the way because I wanted to get in the refrigerator, around him. Doing stuff. I had an older sister, still have an older sister, and doing stuff to her because, I didn't, and I was just constantly getting in trouble. And lying as long as I can remember. So I just, that alcoholic behavior came naturally to me. And I always had that, I want what I want when I want it, which is now, so hurry up and give it to me. I never wanted to work for anything. I didn't want to earn it. I just wanted it to be bestowed upon me, when I was ready for it. And so that, that caused problems, obviously, kind of growing up, a very selfish, self-centered attitude. The only other thing I'll say about that too is, and I say this just kind of for context, but my mom is still around and still emotionally unbalanced, but she was quite abusive, like verbally, emotionally abusive to my sister and I. She would freak out over nothing. You walk in the door, took your shoes off the wrong way, she could explode and start screaming and yelling at you for nothing. And as a little kid, that's you don't know quite what to do, how to process that. So I didn't necessarily, not that I had a bad childhood really, I was always provided for and had needs met, but it wasn't always the happiest. And the other thing about me is it made me very, I to this day, I struggle with, developing relationships, because, either through my own, just childish behavior, which took me a while to outgrow, or whatever, just very self-centered and not good at building relationships, but also not having like safe and healthy relationships at home in my life, so that was a big struggle. But I relate that back to the details. Like, you could have switched me at birth, and given me to parents who were like completely perfect and understanding and knew how to deal with a kid who had that, I still would have been an alcoholic. I just have a different story leading up to whenever I took my first drink. And that's, that's the part that I have to remember. So I don't dwell on that stuff, too much. But, so when I started drinking, which was in eighth grade, I was about 13. It was about this time of year. It was after school one day, walking home with a couple of guys in my grade. And we decided, today was the day we're going to get drunk. It was like, and drinking was always a part of like family life. Both my parents drank and drank daily. My mom, borderline, alcoholic. You could set your watch by her martini. I'll tell you that growing up. And my dad was a heavy drinker, but really just that, a heavy drinker. I don't think he went beyond, into alcoholism, but alcohol was central to everything that went on. And, growing up when I did, the 70s into the 80s, alcohol, it was fashionable to like party or try to be like the bigger kids and steal beer and like the block party on the 4th of July, there'd be the coolers of beer and the kids would always be running around and trying to, grab a beer or whatever. It was just, it just seemed like the normal thing. So, in eighth grade, it felt like, yeah, because I knew kids who were slightly older that were starting to drink, and it was, you know, the proverbial quest to be cool or whatever. But I drank like a true alcoholic from the get-go. So we went to, it was Tom Suplee. I don't know whatever became of him, but both his parents were working, so there was nobody there. And, you know, we were old enough that there wasn't like a babysitter or anything around. So, you know, we came in, and his parents had a quite, you know, well-provisioned alcohol, you know, a liquor cabinet, whatever. They had, you know, they had all the whiskeys, all the clear stuff, the vodkas, the gins, the, you know, and all stuff I still don't know all what is. But I sampled each and every one of those bottles that afternoon. And some, quite a few, chug-a-lugged a good bit. And you might imagine as a, you know, what could I have been? Maybe 130 pounds? I got violently ill. Threw up, fall down, carry me home, bed spins. Oh God, you know, just make it stop. I'll never do it again. You know, that was the first drink. My last drink 10 years in the future, as it turned out, was very similar in that, you know, sort of just, oh, what the hell? And in that case, I drank a case of beer and was like, fall down. But instead of being carried home, you know, like a good drunk, I drove myself home. But, you know, it was the same general sort of story of just, you know, there it is, I might as well drink it, kind of just throw it down. Now, in between, you know, there was a lot of variety and vagary. The other thing I'll say, I know this is AA, but for me, drugs are a big part of, you know, my active addiction. To me, I don't really view drugs and alcohol differently personally. But, you know, I can't sort of, they did have slightly different effects on me. And, you know, as you can imagine, you know, getting violently ill, like every time you drank is not, you know, it's not a great thing. And it was shortly after my first drink, within several months to a year, where I, you know, I discovered marijuana. And so that was like really the first time I really got high was like towards the end of ninth grade. In 10th grade, I became a daily pot smoker. And, you know, the crazy thing about the 80s, it was easier to get weed as a, what was I by then, 15-year-old than it was to get booze. I got to school ridiculously early on the bus, find the right person, get a bag, and I was good for the week, you know, and I was getting high 2, 3, 4 times a day and still drinking. But, you know, that's when things really progressed for me, because I could go through life stoned in a way I couldn't go through life drunk. And, you know, and in the last I'll say, and sort of, you know, focusing back on just my story in general, is that, you know, I was also still pretty young. So by the time I got to my senior year and I'd grown, you know, considerably and matured a bit and had been able to like secure a regular source of beer, you know, beer became, you know, the booze came back into my life in a much bigger way. And, what I was going to say is this thing I heard in an NA meeting I used to go to, alcohol is a drug, period. You know, so for me, as an alcoholic can't do drugs and a drug addict can't drink, you know, to me, it's just, it is addiction. And I try not to get too caught up in that, you know, cause that's another thing I could try to spin myself out of control, trying to like parse or whatever. But so, yeah, you know, high school was pretty rocky, as you can imagine, being that heavily, you know, under the influence. There was a period at some point where I felt like maybe things were getting out of control. But, you know, the other thing about my personality is to this day, it still kind of haunts me, is I have a whole lot of trouble asking for help. And so the idea of like asking for help at that point was just, and I still had no real knowledge or experience of like AA or the program. So I had nothing to like sort of fit into, you know. I was kind of the belief where if like, you know, it's almost like if I did something, I got in trouble, you know, like maybe I drove the car too fast, so I couldn't drive the car for a month. And then I could drive again. You know, you drank too much, so you couldn't drink for a month, and then you could drink again. You know, that was like my kind of idea of like the sort of causal effect or the punishment. You know, I had this the idea of like stopping, you know, completely and trying to stay stopped one day at a time. You know, that was just beyond my comprehension at that time too. Also I had that brief, you know, illusion, you know, like many 17-year-old males, like I'm invincible. You know, I had that brief period where I actually seemed to be able to control it, you know, even though I was partying like a madman. Part of it was because it was my senior year in high school, so you get cut a lot more slack. And so I wasn't being held to as, you know, a tight of whatever. I managed to get myself in college, so that kept like my parents off my back, you know. And once you get yourself into college, you know, the system just pushes you out the door. Essentially, it's like they feel like they've done their job with you. And I was very good at just sliding along, you know, and just riding the wave. You know, I was into like, you know, the '80s were like the revitalization of the '60s, you know, the '60s, that culture, hippie culture, Grateful Dead was very big when I was in high school. And I was into all that, but I never had the long hair. I never, you know, I always, you know, cause like the police pulled me over and they'd be like, take it easy on your way home, you know, cause I had the short hair. I was an athlete. I was like, you know, if I didn't have, you know, more beer in the trunk, they were just like, you know, go be a kid, go on your way, you know. And you know, it's pretty amazing to think about that now, like just how close I came to having my whole life sort of upended early on. But just by looking a certain way, you know, I just skated right on through and right on by. And you know, and that's the other thing about my personality is you know, I'm a lawyer by sort of training, but that also comes naturally to me. You know, I was talking about the lying, you know, the advocacy. I became interested in all that from a very early age because I'd be asking my parents, well, why? You know, why? They say you can't. Well, why? You know, why this? Why? And like, well, who gets to decide? And well, you know, okay, so I'm going to be a lawyer. You know, that was always part of my you know, my makeup, my whatever. And I lost my train of thought a little bit there, but you know, I definitely was sliding through. And then I go off to college, and you know, I knew college was going to be good, but I never really appreciated just how good until we like got there and we were unloading the car, and it dawned on me that in a couple of hours, my parents were going to pull away and I wasn't going to see them for like over a month. And I was just like, you know, it was like, you know, like the cartoon character that has like dollar signs were to go off when they sees it, you know. For me, it was like, hey, you know, it was just like, ching. And, you know, and sure enough, that night I drank all night long. You know, it was like the beer was like endless, you know. And that was the other thing that kept me a little bit in check. You know, A was my parents, because I had to toe a line to sort of get around them. I had to keep it, you know, somewhat in check. You know, it was like, what's that one story where the guy was like shooting up in his garage and then trying to run into bed to pass out. And he's like, I had to like figure out how to get over the uppers and under the and that was me. It's like I had to figure out how to be able to get all the way up into my bedroom without like collapsing or puking, so I could pass out and then like, you know, next morning do it all again. It was like me. It was like running this calculus of like, am I drunk enough, but is it going to hold off long enough for me to get into bed, you know, kind of thing. But getting to college and not having to worry about that, it was just kaboom. And, you know, within a couple of weeks, I really started to realize that maybe I had a problem. You know, it was like, I like quit lacrosse because who wants to get up at like, I forget what early hour to go to practice before like class when you've like only been in bed for a couple hours because you've been out drinking. You know, it was just like the drink was just too important and it was too accessible. And it was just like, but you know, that the thing about like help, you know, like I had no idea how to ask for help then. My solution at that point was, because I just felt like this great sense of loss. Like I had really screwed up and I didn't know how to like unscrew it up. You know, I probably could have if I had simply just gone and asked for help. But that was too foreign for me. My solution, I was just going to drink myself to death. And then somehow in my mind, everybody was going to be sorry. You know, it was like I had some crazy notion that I'd be missed a la like Jimi Hendrix or something. I don't know, you know, a legend in my own mind. And I came pretty close, actually. Early in the second semester, I managed to get through the first semester, sort of. I had a 1.5 grade point average. Those grades came home like Christmas Eve. And, you know, my parents weren't thrilled, but nobody was like all that concerned. Like my dad had had a rocky start to college. One of my uncles had as well at that age. It was just sort of, you know, rite of passage. He'll figure it out. He'll whatever. And of course, by that point, being in college, I was able to drink openly at home. So it was, and that, you know, I was totally enabled in that regard. But anyway, I got back to school and we were partying like mad that first bit before things really got going. And I came to one morning to find myself being put on a stretcher. And you know, I don't know, you know, can't really see me all that well on Zoom. I'm a pretty good big guy. I'm about 6'2" and 230 these days. I can't seem to get under 230, no matter how much I work out. But those days I was a little in better shape, but I was 200 plus and, you know, had been an athlete not too prior to that. So I was still in fairly decent shape. And I fought my way off the stretcher and the ambulance guys were just like, we didn't touch it, you know, to my roommates, and my roommates were freaking out. So what happened is I was having like grand mal seizure, like toxic shock in my bunk bed. And, you know, flopping like a fish out of water. And they called, you know, the 911 or the ambulance or whatever. And the only thing that actually saved my life is the attendants. I was trying to climb back I had the top bunk. And I was trying to climb back. I just need to sleep it off. And they're like, well, you can sleep if you get on the stretcher. And I was like, okay. And I can remember having more seizures, like on the way to the hospital. I can remember looking at the ambulance attendant and like, you know, help me. Like, I can't control this. I don't know what's happening. I remember more in the ER and the doctor freaking out and all this. But remember how I told you I've been lying as long as I can remember? Well, that came into play because I lied my way into a diagnosis of epilepsy. Now, if that's not the biggest case of malpractice in my life, I don't know, because they had my blood. They knew, like, my blood alcohol level was nearly 0.3, it was like 2.8 or something like that. And I hadn't been drinking for hours at that point. Plus, they knew all the other stuff that was in there. And, you know, I was like, oh, I was in a room with some people who were smoking, but I wasn't smoking, you know, and like, whatever, you know. But they put me on Dilantin. And that messed me up more than anything I ever took of my own free will. But that ultimately led, this is 1988 at this point, January. The college I went to actually had a drug and alcohol counselor, and they had a student group on campus. And, you know, part of my discharge, they sort of referred me over there. I guess they do that with all the students who end up in the hospital in town for, you know, drug or alcohol related things. But that led to my exposure to AA, my first AA meetings. And so, you know, I was doing even worse in school at that point, because like I said, the Dilantin really messed me up. Like I couldn't remember day to day whether I was even taking it or not. And I was just an absolute mess. And they offered me a medical withdrawal for that second semester, which basically was going to keep me from failing out. You know, they said, you can get all your grades wiped clean for the semester if you go to rehab. So I was like, sure, get out of jail free card. You know, and I go off through a 30-day program, and it was about this time of year, by the time that all happened, or by the time is getting out, it was definitely March that I was in the rehab, because I remember watching March Madness in the rehab. But I was there not too long, and mind you, I'm 18. Most of the people were in their 30s or 40s. The vast majority were on their third to fifth rehab. Most of them were, you know, their biggest issue seemed to be cocaine. And I couldn't relate or identify to any of them. And nor did I think I really wanted to. And so I decided pretty early on there that I was too young, smart, and good looking to be an alcoholic. Right? It's like, we're a drug addict or whatever. I just, you know, no thanks. You know, you guys, yeah, okay. And what they reinforced to me was like, yeah, cocaine's the problem, right? That's the problem. That's what you stay away from. So I'll just stay in my lane. I'll give up the pot, because yes, that does, you know, mess with me. Because I'd actually had a seizure incident once before I got to college. So that was like my second one. It's just the first one, I was sleeping over with friends, and nobody called the, you know, the ambulance that night. So I was like, you know, if I just do that, and I just listen to my body, right? You know, if I just listen to myself, you know, when I feel like I've had enough, just stop, you know, I don't have to drink 24 beers every night or whatever, you know, was. And so I proceeded to go. And the other thing that I thought was like, if I go back to college and I can graduate and I drink as much as I want to drink, I'm clearly not an alcoholic, right? Sounds good to all of you, right? So that was my plan. And, but you know, as a good alcoholic, that plan went to pot pretty quick. And, you know, for starters, I saw a counselor, like individual counselor, that summer, as sort of like some additional like follow-up. And that was, he was a drug and alcohol guy. He was running the adolescent unit at the rehab I went to. And that was the other thing. Like, I wouldn't have belonged in the adolescent unit either, because they were all like 13 and 14 year olds. I was really kind of in between the populations they had there at the time. And that's, you know, that's just how it was. And, you know, as a good alcoholic, I was not at all looking to identify. I was looking to exclude myself. So that helped enable me, you know, to exclude myself. But so what I would do, I had all these like experiments, you know, I would have like three beers, and cause I was still underage. So like, you know, I wasn't like going to bars, you know, we'd get a six pack with a buddy, and like, we'd each have three beers, and like, you know, nothing bad would happen. I'd go home. My parents couldn't tell, you know, it was like, yeah, see, I can do this. And then maybe I'd have a, you know, and but I would also do this, and then I'd go see the counselor. And you know, the other thing was, like, everybody was talking about Coke, so I figured I better see what that was all about. And I did a whole lot of that summer as part of my, you know, experiment and whatever, and even did it, and then, like, went to see the counselor, and all to prove that, like, see, I'm not, because I can do this and I can function and I can. So I was just like, yeah, I'm ready to go back to school. And, you know, and then just it all, as you can well imagine, it all did. And I wasn't back to college about a month before I had, you know, I had a really bad episode. And my birthday's late September. And this girl I'd met when I went back to school took me to a Grateful Dead concert in Madison Square Garden for my birthday. And that wasn't a lost weekend, but I ended up, you know, doing other substances, having a really bad trip, like leaving the concert, wandering around what I now know is Hell's Kitchen. Just, you know, a nightmare like scenario. And thinking to myself as I'm going, you know, the moment of clarity, and from the Grateful Dead song, you know, like, you get, sometimes you see the light in the strangest of places if you look at it right. So there I am, like, just totally out of my brain, and, like, you know, maybe they were right at rehab. Maybe I really do have an issue with drugs and alcohol. But it was to be 4 more years before I would actually act on that. You know, I had to go back and just continue to go down the slide and the trajectory and the whatever. And to, you know, to speed up that this part of the story, I don't know how well I'm doing on time. I still got plenty of time to go through the what happened and what it's like now. But you know, it was like I related to the toilet bowl. Every year I was a little closer to the bottom. It was just downward spiral. And you know, and particularly the end of my senior year, just like the total, I was at that point, it was the, every morning was, you know, God, make it stop, you know, the hangover, the remorse, my vicious cycle at that time was, you know, my stomach was really shot, like acidy, whatever. I was starting to vomit blood if I drank too much hard alcohol. So in order to eat, like, I had to smoke pot, and then I would get the munchies and stay. And it's like, I understand why they use it for, like, cancer patients or whatever, you know, the effect, or the effect of it, you know, the way it stimulates you, but I had to do that to eat. I had to eat to hold the alcohol, because if I didn't eat, the alcohol just came right back up. And that was my vicious sick. And I needed the alcohol to pass out, because I couldn't sleep, and I couldn't, you know, and I was just like, it was this weird thing, you know, like I was stuck in this, in my loop of, like, college and graduation, but all I was doing at that point was waiting for it to end. You know, it was like, I come 2 in the morning, I'm in college, or I can still drink. Cause it was like, I was like putting it off, you know, and, you know, so much for this proving I'm not an alcoholic by graduating. You know, I graduated by the skin of my teeth, but, you know, I didn't have a job. I didn't have any prospects for a job. I was frankly unemployable. You know, I had some menial sort of jobs at, like, the putt-putt golf place or whatever, but, you know, to, like, an actual job that required, like, you know, brain power. And you know, when I found myself the next fall, because I knew a bunch of people who were then seniors, and I was always back at college. And, you know, I had a particularly bad, you know, bout of, you know, I used to have, like, brownouts all the time, you know, where I lost a little bit of time, or, you know, I forgot about some aspect. But my basic thing was, if I woke up in my own bed, then it was okay. You know, it was like, you know, what, you know, the fact that I couldn't remember at all, who really cared? Because here I am, I made it to where I was supposed to go. But in this night, you know, I was with a group of people, the last I remember. I woke up with like B group of people. And B group of people were a bunch of my roommates from the year before. And it was a different apartment, but, you know, college apartments and the college furniture, you know, it's all the same. And this one friend of ours had drawn this big thing on a sheet. It was, you know, the Count from Sesame Street. And that was hanging on the wall above me. So when I came to, and that's what had been in my last college apartment. So I came to, I literally didn't know when it was. I was that lost. Like, I came to and I was like, wait, what? And then I sat up and my head just exploded. And then, you know, and then I realized just like, I had the biggest like break, you know, like I ever had. And that's what finally got me to be like, you know, I really, now's when I gotta do something. And it was shortly after that that I started going back to meetings. And that didn't go all that well because I wasn't fully yet ready to surrender. And I was still, you know, just sorting through all that stuff and coming to grips with it, I guess, really. And I think, you know, I needed to do that last bit of experimenting, that last bit of, you know, letting it refund my misery, as they say, the last, you know, just, and, you know, and I was also holding on to crazy ideas like, you know, oh, I can smoke pot if I don't drink, or I can drink if I don't, you know, I was still holding on to that. Like, I had tried to drink and not smoke pot and I lasted like 3 months, you know, so I was going to smoke pot and not drink. And that, you know, 3 months of that on and off. And I was in the psych ward. You know, it happened over Christmas. You know, and it was like the bad trip at the Grateful Dead show that just wouldn't stop, you know, and it was getting progressively worse. The TV, the radio, everything was talking to me specifically, and it was saying very mean and nasty things. And it was like, you know, it just, everything, I was just so like paranoid, and I literally was like, I need help. And in the back of my mind, I was also thinking, you know, yeah, I'm crazy. That's it. We fixed this. And then just maybe, you know, that last bit of, you know, maybe someday I can drink again. And you know, I get to the psych ward. And they asked me my whole history and I give it to them. I have nothing to hide at that point, you know, and they take one look at me and they're like, you're not crazy. You're a drug addict and alcoholic. You need to go to a meeting. And I was like, fuck, you know, I was just like, no, that's not what you're supposed to say. You're supposed to say you're really sick and we're going to help you. And then, you know, I'm in the psych ward and those people are really freaking nuts. You know, and I started to realize that as they, you know, as they started to give me like the antipsychotics and whatever like neuroses I was having was like becoming under control. I was just like, these people are really nuts. You know, it's like, yeah, I like to really like party, but these people are nuts. You know, and I don't mean to belittle, you know, mental illness, but it was just like, I needed that sort of like shock to my system, sort of like difference between real mental illness and addiction, you know, and to be, have it painted in that, like in my face. And, you know, so I signed myself in a couple of days after Christmas. I signed myself out. It was actually New Year's Eve. And that was a really crazy time to be coming out, you know, night to come out of the psych ward. But one of the conditions was to go back to rehab, and whatever insurance my dad had at the time meant it was like one of those intensive outpatient places. And so I go to that place for my intake thing. And remember I was telling you about that counselor I had who I used to like go see when I was under the influence to prove like I didn't have a problem. well, who should like see me as I walk in the door but him? And he's like, and he took one look at me and he's like, we got to get you in someplace. And I said, I just got out of someplace. And he's like, oh man. And he just like literally took my file and me and just under my wing and just short-circuited whatever, you know, bureaucracy there was. And that was one of the best things that ever happened to me because that guy helped save my life. And my last drunk was actually, you know, one of my last defiant things, because in the, you know, you can't make this stuff up. The building he was in, his office overlooked the beer distributor next door. That was literally, you know, beer distributor here, inpatient or whatever they call outpatient rehab upstairs next door. But the last case of beer I bought was right there. So that was the start of my ultimately getting sober. You know, I still had a few last hiccups, you know, because I hadn't yet truly surrendered or turned my will and my life over to a higher power. I was still basically trying to run it myself. And I say that now, I see that now. I didn't really see it then. I just, you know, the rehab scared me straight for not even 60 days. I think that's when I got my last, picked up the last case of beer. That was about roughly 28 years ago. Then I had one last, you know, hurrah. Because the other thing I couldn't do, I couldn't truly put down people, places, and things. And was like the people. Because like, I was one of the things that I clung to for so long. Like, if these people will hang out with me, I can't be that bad. Right? Because these were people who were like ticking the sort of check marks in life. They were progressing through college. They were getting a job. They were doing this. They were what, you know, and these are good people. And if good people will associate with me, you know, I can't, but I was basically a happy drunk. You know, you give me tuned up and I wasn't a problem. You know, I just like to feel good. You know, I didn't get into a lot of fights. I wasn't, you know, I was just happy, you know? And so, you know, people didn't mind partying with me, but that's a big difference from like, you know, understanding me and relating to me and, you know, caring about you on a different level. So the last time I used was, as near as I can reckon, cause a good alcoholic faction, I didn't fess up to it like right away. Cause I met the guy who became my first sponsor, who was also very instrumental in, you know, in getting me sober and the whole, like, you know, the we part of the first step. And, you know, we admitted, you know, I can still remember when he had me like over his apartment to go over the first step. And, you know, sits me down and I'm still like really raw and edgy and I'm on different antipsychotics and whatever. And I, you know, part of me is like wondering, like, is this guy like a cult? Is he going to kidnap, you know, just not, still just like unsure about like AA and the program and everything. And so we sit down table. It's like step one. And he's like, stop. Huh? You know, like literally like jumping, like, what? He's like, what's that mean? I'm like, well, it's the first one. He's like, yeah. And then, you know, we admit stop. I'm like, what, you know, we, you know, and just painstakingly going over the first part of step one, like literally word by word, and we, you know, you and me, not you, not me, you and me. And that was like the first time I'd been through what, two rehabs. I don't know, at that point, certainly 100 plus meetings that never like hit me until that point, you know, the power of another alcoholic, you know, talking to you, that communication, you know, and So I'd had that and I, you know, so like I didn't talk about, you know, this last little thing I had and that was with, you know, with pot and actually, of course, is in good alcoholic fashion, I'd stolen it from this guy that I used to like party with. And I can remember I went out, I grew up in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, and Swarthmore College, big, beautiful campus. And I was out in the woods where we always used to go. It was early spring. And I was starting to like feel the effect. And I was like, I don't want this. I remember how distinctly, as soon as I started feeling that old, what used to be the old familiar, like comfort take me to my, like, as soon as I realized I really didn't want that, you know, anymore. And you know, I remember like throwing away, like getting up, stopping, like even debating myself, does this really count? Cause I didn't, you know, but I stayed quiet about it. But I waited until like the next year. Like I didn't say I had a year, like whenever I would have had a year, you know, it was like, I recalculated, but anyway, so that was April 13th, 1993, as near as I can recollect and reconfigure. And, you know, the other part of that, you know, was like, you know, I was really struggling, you know, with like fully committing to the program. And, you know, at least for me, you know, the higher power thing was always a struggle too. Cause I grew up with a religious upbringing, Sunday school. It wasn't Catholic, it was Lutheran, but it was close enough to Catholic that I can relate to a lot of the stuff that I hear people talk about from the Catholic upbringing, but it didn't resonate with me. But at the same time, it's not like I fully disbelieved in a higher power. And so, but I really struggled with this, like, well, who's God? But I said to God, as I understood him at that time, it was like, you know, okay, God, I will do this. You know, I am, I will do this AA thing, but you got 30 days to make me feel better, you know? And that was the start, you know, of my sobriety, because as crazy as I was, as much as I still had the physical urge and the compulsion, at 30 days, I had to admit it was better than it had been 30 days. So I was willing to do another 30 days. And then at 60 days, you know, things had gotten even better, but it still wasn't 100%. But 60 days was more than I'd had since I started, you know, drinking and doing other stuff. So I said, well, what's the harm in another 30 days? You know, and it didn't even take that last 30 days to be like, you know, fully convinced. And, you know, just the kind of things that, you know, I talked about how I was unemployable. And I truly was. I was such a mess, as you might imagine. And I was living, you know, at that time still with my parents. And because I'd learned early on, you know, not to steal from them. Like I couldn't steal from them and get away with it. So I didn't steal from them. I stole from everybody else. So I hadn't like totally burned every bridge I had. But within like a day of like really like sort of letting go, turning it over to God, getting a sponsor, a neighbor asked me to paint this old carriage house in the back of his property. This big old thing that he converted into an apartment. And so I suddenly had a job and it was perfect because I got up, I got dressed, I walked across the street, I worked, I came home, I had lunch, I walked across the street again, you know, I worked in there. That was all I could handle. And that's all I had to do, you know, and it left plenty of time to get to meetings. And on like Fridays, there was this nooner meeting, so I could get to the nooner meeting and then get to the evening meeting. And then usually on Friday, I would hit the, you know, we called it the whackers meeting, the midnight meeting, because I'd be freaking out by midnight on a Friday, you know, because that was like, that was definitely the witching hour. And, you know, and Saturdays were much the same way. But, you know, it just, those type of things, you know, started to happen. And, you know, I started to get grounded, in the fellowship as well. You know, that was an area that, you know, it was definitely some restlessness for a while. You know, after about 90 days or so, I think, or maybe it was closer to 6 months, in the 90 days to 6 months is when I started coming off a lot of the medicine I've been on after the psych ward. So like, you know, I had a nice Prozac pink cloud in part, the, you know, those first like 90 days and stuff, and that started to wear off. And, you know, so the edges became a little realer, and, you know, I finished the job across the street. So then I had to look for like a real sort of job. And that was like a, you know, that was an up and down and all over, you know, experience. Cause I had never applied myself in school. I partied in school, you know, and just slid through. And, you know, I had, you know, my undergraduate degree is in classics. Most people are like, what? They don't even know what it is, you know? And, it's definitely not the kind of thing you pursue, if you want to go like into business. It's the kind of thing like me, if you know or think you want to go to law school eventually and you want the easiest major you can find, that's classics. You know, because like history, it had this huge research paper assignment. It was like notoriously hard at the school. And political science had a couple professors that were like notoriously difficult, and, you know, what, on and on and on. And, you know, and forget the sciences, they actually made you work in those classes, you know, and all the kids who thought they wanted to be doctors, you know, they were like weeding them out. And I don't know. So in any event, you know, that was, you know, a bit of a reality check. But, you know, it helped me to re-galvanize and refocus. And, you know, after couple years of sobriety, I got myself into law school, and I went away to law school, and that started a whole new, you know, like growing experience. Cause not only am I, you know, like fully on my own for the, like the first time, not that I wasn't taking care of myself and cooking for myself and stuff when I was still living with my parent, but I was truly, there was nobody else there. You know, I had my own apartment. It was just me, but it was also, it was, you know, 6 hours drive from where I grew up. So it wasn't like I was in the same area. It was new meetings, new people, new everything. And I really, you know, that was a real growing process, because, you know, I did the thing where I started, even though I went to meetings from the get-go, you know, being in law school, I didn't have time to make it to a meeting every day the way I used to. So it was, you know, it was more like 3 or 4 meetings a week. And the place I went is actually in a pretty rural area. So meetings were literally like, you get on the interstate and drive for 30 minutes to get to a meeting kind of thing. And so, you know, there's some excuses built in, but I wasn't, you know, these weren't the people who saw me bouncing in and out of the rooms and into the psych ward for 6 months and then eventually get sober and knew me like, and could call me on my stuff. These were people who just, oh yeah, he's that kid, you know, or whatever, you know? And so I would say, when I would share at a meeting, I would say what I thought maybe I should say or sound like, or thought sounded good, or, and I didn't really have a sponsor at that point, and I wasn't, you know, so I wasn't really, didn't have that one-on-one connection, and that led to a bottom in sobriety that I'm very fortunate to say didn't take me out, but it actually got me, you know, I had, you know, sort of long story shorted as best I can, you know, a woman was involved. She didn't choose me. She chose somebody else. And that created, for a guy who'd never really had much of a relationship, particularly in his drinking, not that anybody would have wanted any kind of relationship with me, believe, you know, but a very, you know, that just like the jealousy, I had never felt anything like that before in my life. And it was like to the point where I had like physical reaction to that type of, those type of emotions. And, you know, it's like, you understand why it's like they considered it, you know, one of the deadly sins or whatever. But I literally woke up a couple of mornings feeling like if I'm going to feel like this, I might as well drink. And, but the beauty of it was I didn't drink, and I went to a meeting and I talked about it, you know, as best I could. And I found a new sponsor and I started working the steps again. And eventually, you know, came out of that. And it helped that at about that same time, that was the end of the semester. It was my second year, and I was coming back to this area for the summer for a job, this area being Philadelphia. And so the space helped, and it helped that I got back and being around, you know, the people I got sober with and the meetings I knew. You know, and then just continued on, you know, in that path. You know, to say it's all been, you know, a bed of roses since then, no, it's life, you know. But I, over and over again, you know, the examples of, you know, that AA is the easier, softer way. You know, I have seen it numerous times. You know, I've heard the story about, you know, it goes something like, I stopped going to meetings, I stopped calling my sponsor, I stopped hanging out with people in the program, and I drank again. I've heard variations on that story countless times over the years. It has never ended with, it got better. It invariably ends, you know, with, it was worse than ever. Within, you know, weeks, I was, you know, or days or whatever, the person is, you know, miserable. You know, it's out there. I've also seen people go through everything at this point, you know, from, you know, illnesses and accidents and job losses and whatever, and stay sober, you know, and knowing that the support that is needed to get through those events, you know, is here in AA, in the program. You know, I try to stay involved in service as best I can. So been a little different, you know, over the last year, as we're all too well aware, you know, but I try to be there, you know, for my home group. We started doing nightly Zoom meetings, at least weekdays, with a different format, you know, every day, because that was actually my idea, hearkening back to, you know, that first sponsor, you know, go to a meeting every day, make sure in a week you go to one big book meeting, you go to one step meeting, and then, you know, beyond that, he didn't care quite as much, but suggested, you know, they're not all speakers meetings. Nothing against speakers meetings, as I'm here speaking at one, but you know, I know for me that if I go to a steady diet of speakers meetings, I start to go a little batty. So I try to, you know, stay involved with literature meetings on a regular basis. You know, lately sponsorship has always been an up and down thing with me. You know, that my first sponsor, who, you know, I try to remain grateful for, because I truly believe, like, I wouldn't be sober without him. He was that, you know, instrumental in early on and getting me in the door and over the hump and whatnot. But, you know, I was about 10 months sober or something. And I remember he told me who God is, as I understand him, was, meaning, like, you know, like, that phrase is applied to me. He's like, well, that's your God. And I'm like, wait, what? And I, you know, I had enough exposure to AA at that meeting to be like, you know, no, that's, you know, that's not right. And at least not right for me. And, you know, I never called him again after that. And, you know, and I've struggled over the years with maintaining, you know, relationships with sponsors. And part of that's like ego and pride, right? I'm, what am I, like 51 going on 28 years sober. So if you're going to sponsor me, you better be, you know, like at least like 60 with 40 years sobriety, right? You know, right? You know, it's like this idea that like I couldn't learn from somebody with 5 years sobriety or a newcomer or whatever. You know, I get hung up on these things, and, you know, in my mind, well, what are they going to teach me? What do they know? What do I know that I don't know? You know, but I've also, you know, there's people, I'm fortunate enough to have a lot of people in my life with a lot of sobriety, you know, because by not drinking and not dying one day at a time, you know, and hanging out with people with the same experience of not drinking and, you know, and not dying, you know, it, you build up that fellowship, that network. You know, irony of ironies is today I am good friends with someone who was at the same college as I was at about the same time. And we just missed crossing paths back then, because I was in and out of the campus sobriety thing, like about a semester before he went in. And he actually went in, and he's been sober ever since college. And, you know, I had to get out on the other side. You know, and part of that, like I was talking about, you know, I'm so, you know, I was talking about getting away with stuff. You know, part of the thrill for me about drinking was drinking underage. It wasn't half as fun, like when I could just go legally buy it. It was still a necessity, but it just wasn't as, the thrill was gone, as they say. I meant to say this early on, but, you know, I believe in the sayings of, and you can flag me if I'm, it looks like I've hit about the hour, but I'll wrap it up with, you know, I'm a big believer of, you know, like, stick with the winners. You know, who's got what you think you want? You know, that was something I learned early on. Who are the happy people in sobriety? Who are enjoying themselves? Who are getting the most out of life? You know, because like I said, I didn't get sober to be miserable. I was plenty miserable on my own, thank you. You know, and like they say, alcohol will gladly refund your misery. So I truly, you know, believe that that's out there waiting for me. The steps, which I had wanted to touch on a little more, you know, are the easier, softer way. You know, gratitude, I try to remember that, because that helps keep me humble, and remind me of how good, you know, I have it. I've been married over 20 years now to someone else in the program. We have two kids who are twins, a boy and a girl, who are over 16 now. You know, never seen either of us drink. Are remarkably well adapted. You know, I think of myself at their age and what an insane knuckle brain I was. And, you know, and I can't believe it. The only thing I can attribute that to is this program, right? And trying to practice these principles in all my affairs, and that somehow reflects, you know, on them. You know, you know, and for me, I can't imagine, you know, not being, you know, or being in a relationship with somebody who's not in the program. It's just that, like, fundamental to me in my life, you know, and it has given me all those things, you know, like, I understand beyond your wildest dreams. I still, you know, I'm still an alcoholic, so I still have the wilder than wildest dreams, but I understand beyond your wildest dreams now too. And, you know, so what I was trying to get out there, you know, if what I said resonated with you, great, take it, use it. I hope it helps. If not, you know, that's okay too. Because, you know, I believe there's as many ways to work the program, you know, as there are drunks on the bus, so to speak, just as there's as many ways to God as there are people, you know, and if what I have, you know, works, great. But, you know, trust in the program, the wisdom that is there. I guess that's it for this part of that.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Awesome. Everybody has the ability to unmute and thank Chris.
Thanks, Chris. Glad you're here,
thanks,
brother.
Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, I'll take the meeting back for a moment, give Chris a chance to exhale. And let's see, we'll do a little business here. Just a reminder, please, if you have questions you'd like answered, please chat those to the user questions in the chat. And let's see, the seventh tradition, excuse me. Read the self-support green card. I placed a link in the chat. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements tonight for the good of AA? Ebony.
Hey guys, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ebony. Hi, if Ebony. You are a woman with a year or more of sobriety and would love to be of service, the Tidewater Intergroup Corrections Committee needs you. We need you. On Tuesdays at 12:30, they take a meeting into the women's jail. They need people to host the meeting. They need people to attend the meeting. They need people to speak at the meeting. Whichever way you're willing of being of service, we are willing to have you be a part of it. If you're interested and you're a lady with a year or more, you don't have to be a lady. I mean, I'm not all the time. We want you there. So I'll put the info in the chat. It's corrections at tidewaterintergroup.org, and we will hook you up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ebony. And it has come to my attention that the chat was disallowed. It is now open for you to chat your questions. So if you had one, please try again. Awesome. Thank you. Let's see. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. Oh, come on, we need those questions, guys. What's up? All right, Chris. Thank you so much, man. That was awesome. I got a couple here. Did that first sponsor take you up to the inventory before you went away to law school?
Yeah, my first sponsor was sort of big on the idea of you know, right after the steps, not waiting. One of the other things he did was turn me on to some of the other AA literature, like Pass It On, which is essentially Bill's bio, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. You know, the one I can never seem to get myself through is AA Comes of Age, which is all about the sort of the convention and whatnot. Long-winded way of saying he was like, you know, as the story goes, Dr. Bob was out making amends on day one. So he was all about, you know, right into it. So we were at sort of the 10th step phase, 10th, 11th step at that 10-month mark when we had that sort of break. So, yeah, I had, for what it was worth at that time, I had done, you know, everything certainly up to 10, probably into 11. And, you know, I've subsequently I've gone through it all again with a different sponsor, actually a couple of different times. And, you know, I'm sort of, I guess I could be better at the old, more regular, you know, it talks about like we recently did the 10th step, in the step meeting. And it talks about the different types of house cleanings and like the daily, the spot check, the semi rate annual or whatever annual. You know, I could probably be better at doing a more thorough like annual type thing, but I try to be pretty good about the daily, certainly on a everyday basis, because it's funny. Some of the things just become so ingrained. Fortunately, at least for me, you know, that it doesn't, you know, like even with my kids, you know, I was talking about, you know, just like how, you know, and particularly dealing, it's been real tough, as you might imagine, for an adolescent going through this. They've been doing a lot of virtual schooling, not being able to do all the things that kids should be doing. And just how well they've adapted. But, you know, I have to apologize to them all the time when I lose my temper when that happens, because I'm human and they're teenagers, I apologize, you know, and sometimes I have to wait for the right moment, like later in the day or whatever, let things cool down. But, you know, I definitely try to keep up with the inventory. So.
What was that? What was that first step 4 or 5 experience for you? First time you went through it?
Yeah, I was one of those assholes who were like, I'm thinking more like 6, 7 actually on that point, where like I don't have any defects anymore. I stopped drinking. You know, it was. In some ways, it's hard to remember. But it was actually a little different too. If you recall, I talked about, I had essentially two sponsors. I had, you know, my like regular AA sponsor, but I had that counselor because I was still going through this outpatient thing and the follow-up. And he saw me probably more than he was supposed to see me, but he knew I needed like the extra help. And, you know, there were certain things that I actually did sort of a part of my fourth step with him, like right at the get-go, because I had one of those things that haunted me that I was like, well, if there really is a, you know, like a hell, I'm certainly going there for this, you know. And I remember telling him that, actually I had forgotten about that, but I remember telling him that very early on, and he looked at me and was like, so what? You know, or you think you're the only one who's ever done that? And it just like, it totally you know, it just, that was like almost more monumental than my actual first, fourth and fifth step. Cause that was something that had haunted me for sort of years really. And, but yeah, that, I mean, that's a pretty powerful, I think, experience. And I certainly, you know that's a hang up for a lot of people. And I also know that that's the point where, you know, the people who refuse to do that, a lot of times those are the people who go back out. And, you know, I that's the thing that scares me more than anything. It keeps me coming back and keeps me, you know, trying to keep progressing. I don't want to be one of those people who goes back out. I have no interest in finding out how bad it will be if I go back out, because I know how hard it was to get in once. I don't want to, you know, the idea of thought of having to come back and say, oh, I, you know, that to me is like fate worse than death. So I think I got off topic there a little bit, but.
Oh, it's okay. We have a question here. What meaningful amends have you made throughout your sobriety?
I think in part, not to sound, try to sound too corny, but the most meaningful amends is just being, you know, just a regular person, if you will. You know, because the people who were most impacted by my drinking were my family, my closest family, and you know, the ones who, you know, you may have your issues with and their hangups and the faults, but who truly want, you know, the best for you. And you know, a lot of the other stuff I did was just kind of stupid little kind of piddling stuff, and but just, you know, being a good son, brother, father, husband, etc., and being, you know, a respectable part of life, you know, that is the most meaningful when I stop and think about it. And you know, I my one grandmother, who remains about the nicest, sweetest person I ever met, you know, the worst thing she would say is, he makes me so mad I could spit. Or she, you know, when something upset her, she'd say, they make me so mad I could spit. That was like cussing somebody out for her. And you know, and I stole from her, and she knew I was stealing from her, and you know, and this, but anyway, she was, that Christmas where I lost it and ended up in the psych ward, we pretty much knew that was going to be her last Christmas. She had formed Parkinson's and was deteriorating. And so I was around 90 days sober the last time I saw her, and I was the last person to see her. My parents were away. She was in a facility that, you know, they called, it was, you know, my mom's mom. So they called our house to let her know. And I didn't know what else to do. So I went and I saw her, and, you know, she knew I was trying to get sober. And, you know, I often wonder, I think there's more to my family history and sobriety than I know, because she knew, she was two of her best friends that we used to call aunts, who were not, you know, aunts, who were just family friends, were both, you know, wives of alcoholics. And like, I never knew my grandfathers, either one of them, both died before I was born. So I just don't know what might be there or not. But anyway, you know, I can remember telling her, because she would always ask about, you know, like, are you going to meetings? Are you doing? And I the last thing I said to her was, I'm still going AA. And that's got to be the most meaningful thing for me. It's just being able to say I'm still going.
Thank you. So we have a question here. Can you share some of your 11-step practices?
I've had different ones over over the years. You know, I like the St. Francis of Assisi prayer. I think that's a good one to like, you know, as a rote sort of almost just a, like a mantra. It hasn't been one I've been doing as much lately, but that is one. I certainly, there was a time where I had it memorized cold. I mean, I still mostly know it, kind of, it's in there, but you know, I think that is a good one. You know, for me, you know, it talks about, you know, all the different ways of meditating and things. And honestly, one of the greatest things for me is walking my dogs early in the morning. I'm very fortunate to live right basically across the street from a huge open park, woods, trails, creek. And I go in there, let my dogs off the leash, and we start walking. We have these paths we go. There are mornings where, and this one loop that we do most frequently in the mornings, you have to cross the stream twice, like little stepping stones. I'll find myself like approaching the second crossing, and I can't remember the first crossing because I'm so just like out into the open, just, you know, that openness, the quietness before anybody else gets in there, which is harder and harder these days because, you know, with this wonderful pandemic we've been going through, a lot more people are using that park. So I have to get up like earlier and earlier to get in there before anybody. But just that bit of like nature, the quietness, you know, watching the sun come up or the, you know, the change, it allows my brain to settle. It allows me to, you know, to remember, you know, the sort of tidbits. But, you know, honestly, that's been a bit of a struggle of more of late because, you know, a part that I didn't quite get to in the now is, you know, after 20 years of being a lawyer in law firms and going like crazy, in 2019, April, it's almost 2 years, I left my firm without knowing what was next. And that process has been kind of crazy and scary. And this whole, you know, situation we're in hasn't helped that. But, you know, while I've done some sort of odd jobs, as it were, I don't have, you know, like that next, like regular, steady, full-time job. And, you know, I truly believe that there's some sort of lesson here. Like I know I made the right decision because when I left that, it was very reminiscent to me of the whole surrendering thing. Cause it was like, you know, I had wanted to do this for so long and all my life. But at that point I was really, it got miserable. You know, I didn't like it anymore. I didn't want to do it anymore. And just being able to admit that to myself was like a huge, you know, process. But, you know, I'm really struggling with, you know, this idea of like, well, what's next? You know, like I'm really trying to make myself open, you know, to my higher power to see the inspiration and like, where am I supposed to go? But I feel like I'm getting a lot of nothing. And that can be hard, you know? So like I say, the 11 step thing is, I think that's one of the hardest, you know, things, because I don't begrudge anyone who gets something out of religion and the ritual and the ceremony, but it honestly does not speak to God, to me. You know, this program speaks to me of a higher power. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. If there were any more, I wouldn't be here, because I'm such, you know, an arrogant alcoholic that would have been too much. You know, it could have been, you might not be able to tell, but what left of my hair is red. You know, that might have been a requirement. You know, you have to have red hair. That's too much, even though I had it. You know, it's just like that, the program and the way it comes together. And I love the traditions. I love step meetings that do a tradition every month, you know, because they're such an important part of it. And I forget now exactly which tradition it is, but Rule 62, you know, don't take yourself so damn seriously. You know, all the trial and error that went into AA, there was this like clubhouse. They literally had that many rules and they fell apart. And then they finally, you know, the lesson was, you know, don't take yourself so seriously. And the way that AA works and has grown and is spread around the world, you know, that to me, and is open to anyone, right? You know, you, as long as you have a desire to stop drinking, what is more beautiful than that and simple? You know, and that, you know, speaks to me of a higher power, but I can't find that like purity, you know, that easily elsewhere in my life, at least not all the time. And, but, you know, I try, and that's all I can do. And that's what I got, you know, that's why I was saying about gratitude. I got to remember, like, I'm fortunate enough that I'm still making the mortgage payment despite all this. You know, I'm still, you know, things are not, you know, exactly where I would like them to be, but I've still got it pretty damn good. And that's all because, you know, of AA. So I just got to keep saying, all right, idiot, you know, what am I missing? You know, and I think some of that is it, you know, that ties back into the inventory and the reflection, you know, and just continuing to be willing to do those things. And maybe it's just bad luck too, you know, it's, you know, and, you know, I don't know, but I just, you know, it's like, what the hell's the expression, but the basic idea, you know, God will move mountains, but you better bring a shovel. You know, it's just like, just the willingness to do, you know, sort of what is there, and just trying to remember that and look for the, you know, the next right thing. And sometimes it's just as simple as that. But I can really complicate all that, as you can see by my rambling answer to that question.
Well, we did run out of time, but there, I'm going to sneak one in. It's a throwaway, 15 seconds. How do you keep from taking yourself seriously, too seriously?
You know, you just got to be able to laugh at yourself. And for that, I really would say, oh man, my mind just went blank. But oh, you know, there is a God. I'm not it, you know. And
right on. Thank you so much, Chris. You've been so generous to come and share with us tonight. I'm going to thank everybody who participated. Thank you, Larry. Sorry, I closed down the chat. I get a little button happy. Everyone will be able to unmute for the Lord's Prayer and thank Chris again. And I wonder if I could get a volunteer to read the last, technically three paragraphs on page 164. Please feel free to unmute and do it. Ebony. I can only see two people now. Oh, did I not give you the permission? I might be. I didn't give you the permission. Okay, you're good. I'll put it back up.
Hey, y'all, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ebony.
Hi, Ebony.
A Vision for You, Big Book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you so much. Thank everybody. Feel free to unmute. Let's have a confusing, raucous Lord's Prayer. Moment of silence and the Lord's Prayer, please. Our Father.
Our Father.
Lord in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come.
Will be thy name.
Amen.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you all.
I know what it's like to be hallucinating when you leave Madison Square Garden and wander around.